Chapter 5. "Why am I so nervous?" asked Stephen, as he rode back towards Portsmouth. "My mind is in a silly flutter. Pursues no clear line. Flies off. Why, oh why, did I leave my pouch of leaves behind?" This was the perfect opportunity for them to show their powers, so very much superior to those of the poppy, which provided little more than a stupid tranquillity. "Though there is something to be said for a stupid tranquillity at times," he reflected, remembering that Petersfield possessed an apothecary's shop, where, before now, he had purchased laudanum. "Vade retro Satanas!" he cried, dismissing the thought. Clouds were piling high in the southwest. The evening was well advanced, and night would fall earlier than usual, almost certainly bringing rain. He had abandoned his lanes long since, and he was now steering for the main London to Portsmouth road, which he would strike a little above Petersfield. The broad, even verges would make his journey much quicker. He could not easily miss his way, and as Sir Joseph had said, with his pale smile, there was not indeed a moment to lose. Since mood is so freely conveyed not only from person to person, but from person to dog, cat, horse, and the other way about, some part of his present state of mind derived from Lala, though her unusual and nervous volatility arose from a cause that could not possibly have been more remote. The season of the year, her temperament, and a variety of other factors had inspired her with a notion that it would be delightful to meet with a fine, upstanding stallion. She skipped as she went, sometimes dancing sideways, sometimes tossing her head. Her views were evident to other members of her race, and poor, rueful geldings rolled their eyes, while the only stone horse they passed raced madly round and round his paddock, neighing, while a pretentious jackass uttered a huge, sobbing cry that followed them beyond the cultivated land to the edge of a barren common, where a broad lane joined their present road, the two running on to join the highway by a gallows. Pleased with her success, Lala whinnied, arched her neck, and curvetted to such a degree that Stephen cried, "Avast, avast there, belay! Why, Lala, for shame!" and reined in hard to bring her to a halt at the foot of the gallows, always a point of interest for an anatomist, even one as deeply harassed as Maturin. This ill-omened place at the junction of the lanes, with scrub on either hand, perfect for an ambush, had been chosen for the exhibition of awful examples, but they did not seem to have much deterrent effect, since they had to be renewed with such regularity that the two pairs of ravens from Selborne Hanger came over at least twice a week for fresh supplies. By now the light was too poor for Stephen to make any worthwhile observations, but at the edge of his field of vision he did catch a movement in the furze. It might have been a goat. There were several at large. But at the same moment he regretted a long, accurate, revolving pistol, the gift of a French intelligence agent, that he usually carried when he travelled by night. He pushed Lala forward, but she was hardly beyond the point where the two roads joined when there was a thunder of hoofs behind him. When he was riding Lala, Stephen wore no spurs. He carried no whip. Now he urged her on with knees, heels, and all the moral force he could exert, yet she took shockingly little notice, barely reached a hand gallop. The hoofs came closer, closer. They were abreast on either side, a band of foolish, unmounted, ogling geldings, colts, and farm horses from the common, as Lala had obviously known from the beginning. "Yet even so," said Stephen, when the gateway was closed behind them and they were trotting along the Portsmouth Road, "there is a gunsmith in Petersfield, and I believe I shall buy a pair of little pocket pistols." They baited at the Royal Oak. Here Stephen found that he had forgotten not only Duhamel's weapon, but his own money too, and it was only on the chance discovery of a 7-shilling piece that he had put in a side pocket as a curiosity that he was spared an embarrassing and perhaps thoroughly disagreeable experience. "Joseph's message carried its shadow before it," he reflected. "Of course it did. I have really let my wits go so far astray." Riding on through the steady rain, he let his mind return to Duhamel, an agent who, ill-used and perhaps about to be sacrificed by his government, had changed sides, providing Stephen with proof of the treachery of Ray and Ledward. From Duhamel, whom he had thoroughly liked, he moved on to other agents, dwelling on the man they called MacAnon, a well-placed Norman from Vauville, who used to slip across to Alderney to see an unofficial wife, and who, like others in the same fragile posture, had been turned, all the more easily because he hated Buonaparte with a strong personal hatred both as a vulgar Italian upstart and as one who had refused his scheme for an improved system of telegraphic signals. Macanon, high in the communications department, had provided them with some very fine long-range forecasts, and it was he who lay behind the secret orders that Jack Aubrey would open when he reached a stated latitude and longitude, orders telling him that a French squadron of roughly equivalent strength, but accompanied by transports, would assemble at Lorient at a given date, and that with the help of three separate diversions it would sail as nearly as possible to a stated full moon. The intention of the French commander was to steer across as though for the West Indies, by way of deluding any possible observers, and then to head for the southwest coast of Ireland, there to land his troops on the shore of the Kenmare River, or Bantry Bay, as time and weather and the movements of the Royal Navy served. Macanon, a valuable man, though, as Blaine had said, their hold on him was weaker now that the unofficial wife had taken to wearing hair curlers in the daytime and to talking in a little girl's voice. Yet even so, it was probable that his loathing of the imperial regime, his enjoyment of the perilous game, and his friendship for the man who dealt with him would keep him active and reliable. But how difficult it was to tell. There were some very intelligent men on the other side, wonderfully adept at poisoning the springs of intelligence. He remembered Abel, a devoted and wholly disinterested ally in Paris, whose chiefs had, by accident, allowed him to see Admiral Duclerc's plan of an attack on a Baltic convoy, and shortly before his death he had sent it over in all good faith. Knowing the agent so well, Blaine's deputy, Blaine was in Portugal at the time, had acted at once, but to their astonishment the additional ships sent to guard the merchantmen found themselves heavily outnumbered. The convoy was terribly mauled, a gun brig was taken, a sloop destroyed, and HMS Molampus was only saved by the descent of a providential fog, though with very heavy casualties, including Jack's friend, her captain, the loss of two topmasts, and grievous damage to her hull. Difficult situations. Difficult situations. And if Jack was still aboard, there would be another within the hour. Commodore Aubrey was, of course, much overworked, as any man ordered to sea in so short a time, with such indifferent preparation, and so many sudden changes, must necessarily be. Yet he was better equipped than most for a situation of this kind. Like many big men, he was not easily put out of temper. He did not use up much of his energy in expostulation. Upon the whole, he despised those who complained, and the entire course of his professional career had fitted him for his present role. On the other hand, he was quite remarkably defenceless when it came to dealing with jealousy. It was an emotion he had apparently never known, at least not in its present consuming state, and it was one whose nature and development he scarcely seemed to recognize at all, so that he was unable to call upon intelligence for what help it can bring in these cases. Stephen was well acquainted with this blindness where health was concerned.
"It is only a lump. It will soon go away."
And affections.
"She has certainly not received my letter. The posts are so slow these days, and very far from shore."
Yet even so it surprised him in Jack Aubrey, a much more intelligent man than he seemed to those who did not know him well. With great concern he had watched the progress of the disease, the changes in the atmosphere at Ashgrove Cottage, where Mr. Hinksey continued to call with the most unlucky regularity, often appearing a few moments before Jack left, and the beginning of a change in the Bellona. Jack was still very kind to him, and in matters to do with a squadron he was perfectly agreeable to those around him, but every now and then a sudden rigour, a peremptory tone, startled those who had served with him before, and made his new subordinates look at him rather uneasily. Were they to sail with another St. Vincent, otherwise known as Old Jarvey, or even as Old Nick, for his ferociously taught discipline? Clearly, this particular, and in Stephen's opinion, totally unnecessary trial was telling on Jack Aubrey's temper most severely. Stephen regretted the whole foolish matter extremely, the suffering of the two chiefly concerned, and of those around them, the utter impossibility of playing the kind intervening friend who puts everything right with a few quiet, understanding words, perhaps conveyed parabolically. And at this juncture his regret was singularly immediate. A personal, directly interested regret, since he was going to ask a favour that even an uncommonly well-disposed, unhurried and benevolent naval commander would hesitate to grant, let alone a man in the throes of readying a squadron for the sea, with a half-acknowledged monster at the same time devouring him within. Lala stopped and looked round at him. Was she to go into Portsmouth, or carry on by the back lane home? "To the left, hussy," he said, pushing his knee into her side. He had not yet quite forgiven her for making such a fool of him by the gallows, but by the time they reached the Keppel's Head he relented and he ordered her bran mash with treacle in it, her favourite indulgence, before going out on the hard in search of a boat, since the ostler had told him that Jack's horse was still in the stable.
"Bellona's a great way over, sir," said the boatman, "and you will have a long, wet pull. Would you like this here piece of sailcloth, since you have forgot your cloak?"
In spite of the sailcloth, Stephen was wet to the skin well before they reached the ship. As they approached her busy, well-lit side, the boatman observed that Thames's barge was at her starboard chains.
"Look at 'em, like a parcel of popinjays," he said, nodding at Captain Thomas's bargeman, all dressed in the same showy garments like a band of damp Merry Andrews. "I dare say it's larboard for you, sir."
"Certainly," said Stephen, "and were you to call out that I should like a small convenient ladder, if it is available, I should be obliged."
"The boat ahoy!" called the Bellona.
"Ho!" replied the boat. "Coming here?"
asked the Bellona.
"No, no,"
said the boatman, meaning thereby that he was coming there, but that he had grasped, without much difficulty, that his passenger was not a commissioned officer, and then, raising his voice,
"The gentleman would be obliged for a small convenient ladder, if available."
This was received with a startled silence for an even longer moment than the boatman had hoped, and he was filling his lungs, suppressing his mirth, for a repetition, when a number of familiar voices called out that the doctor was not to move, he would slip in the rain, he was to stay there, they would bring him aboard. This they did, surprises to a man. On deck they plucked at his clothing and told him he was wet, wet through. Why had he not put on his cloak? With the wind in the southwest, he ought always to put on his cloak. He was making his way aft when Captain Pullings intercepted him.
"Oh, doctor," said he, "the Commodore is engaged at the moment. Will not you shift your coat, at least? You will catch your death else. Mr. Summers," this to the officer of the watch, "stand by, any minute now."
"Mr. Dove," said Summers to the boatswain, "stand by, any minute now."
A boatswain's mate leant over the rail, looking down into the barge. He caught the coxswain's eye and gave an unofficial nod, full of significance. A door right aft opened. A deep voice, now no longer muffled, said in a tone of strong displeasure,
"That is all I have to say. This will not occur again. Good day to you, sir."
Captain Thomas came out, pale with emotion, carrying the Thames's punishment register under his arm. He gave the officers on the quarterdeck little more than a nod as he was piped over the side with full ceremony. With a knowing look, Tom Pullings said to Stephen,
"The cabin is clear now, Doctor, if you choose to go along."
"There you are, Stephen,"
cried Jack, looking up from his desk, a more natural smile doing away with the severity of his expression.
"Have you come back? God's my life, you are soaked quite through. Should you not change your shoes and stockings? It is always said that the feet are the weakest part. Take Achilles' heel. But you know all about Achilles' heel."
"Presently. But for the moment, Jack..."
"Well, in any case, take a dram to keep the wet out. Sea water does no harm, but rain is deadly stuff once it gets right in."
He swung round, took a case bottle from the locker, and poured them each a tot of rum, a glorious rum he had drawn from the wood in Trafalgar year.
"Lord, I needed that," he said, putting down his glass. "How I do loathe a steady, indiscriminate flogger."
He glanced down at his papers, and the stony look returned.
"Jack," said Stephen, "I have not chosen my moment well. I have a request. I have a favour to ask, and I could have wished to find you with a mind reposed, but you have clearly had a trying day."
"Ask away, Stephen. I shall be no better tempered tomorrow. Ill humour seems to have settled in my bosom,"
striking it,
"much as the wind used to settle in the southeast and stay there when we were trying to claw out of Port Mahone week after week."
A silence, and in a harsh voice Stephen said,
"I should like to borrow the Ringle, if you please, with a proper crew, for a private voyage to London as early as can be."
Jack fixed him with a piercing stare that Stephen had never seen before.
"You know we sail on Wednesday's ebb?"
he asked, having looked at Stephen's face in an objective manner.
"I do. But may I say that if the wind does not serve, I should certainly join you at the Groyne or off Finisterre."
Jack nodded. Stephen went on,
"I must add that this is an entirely personal need. a private emergency."
"So I had gathered," said Jack. "Very well, you shall have her. But with the weather that promises, I doubt you can come down in time. Do you mean to spend long in town?"
"Only long enough to load some chests near the tower."
"How many tides do you reckon?"
"Tides? To tell you the truth, Jack, I had not thought of tides. And then," he said in a low, diffident voice, "I'd hoped to put into Shelmerston for perhaps a night."
"I see."
Jack rang a bell.
"Good Captain Pullings, spare him a minute." "Tom," he said, "the doctor has occasion for the tender to run up the London River directly. Let him have Bondon and Reed and as discreet a set of old shipmates as you can think of, enough for watch and watch with two to spare. He may not be able to rejoin before the Groyne or Finisterre. Let her be victualled for the Burlings with the utmost dispatch."
"The utmost dispatch it is, sir," said Tom, smiling. "I am very deeply obliged to you, Jack, my dear," said Stephen.
"There is no such thing as obligation between you and me, brother," said Jack.
And in another tone,
"It will take some little time. She's over by Gilkicker. But you should clear at the height of flood. I am sorry I was a trifle chuffed to begin with. I have had an uncommon wearing day. So have you, by your look, if I may be so goddamned personal. What do you say to a pot of coffee?"
Without waiting for an answer, he rang the bell and said,
"Killick, large pot, and the doctor will need half a dozen shirts put up, as well as a dry coat and stockings this minute."
They drank their coffee, and Jack said,
"Let me tell you about my rough day. Apart from my battle with the victualling yard and that ass, Thomas, he will end up like Piggott or Corbett if he goes on like this. Food for the less particular fishes. I had gone ashore to see how my second chronometer was coming along, the Arnold, that needed cleaning, when I ran into Robert Morley of the Blanche. She lies at St. Helens, fresh from Jamaica. I literally ran into him. He did not see where he was going, and knocked him into the kennel. I picked him up and dusted him, and carried him into the Keppel's Knob, where I called for a glass of shrub, which I knew Bob Morley had always liked. But he still looked horrid pale, and I asked him, was he hurt? Should I send for a surgeon? No, he said, he was perfectly well, and he leant on the table with the tears running down his face. His ship had come in before daylight, and he had pulled ashore, hurrying up to their house for breakfast. Well, he found his wife 6 months gone with child. He had been away for 2 years. She was terrified. His father-in-law was there, an elderly parson, and he told Bob he was not to abuse her or be unkind. He was not to throw a stone unless he was sinless himself, and not even then if he was a good man. Now, as you know very well, Bob Morley, though excellent company and a tolerable good seaman, has never set up for chastity any more than I have, though he carried things much farther. In the West Indies he always cruised with a miss aboard, and he allowed his officers and even mids so much liberty when he had the Semiramis that she was a floating bawdy house that the Admiral himself took notice of."
"Her surgeon died of the pox."
"Well, I tried to put this to Bob. I tried to say he could not decently blame anyone for doing what he so notoriously did himself. Of course he came out with a parrot cry, 'Oh, it is different for women.'"
"What did you say to that?"
"I did not say I thought it was a mere scrub's reply, which I do, because he was in a very sad way. So I just suggested that it was the general cant. Great nonsense. The act was the same for both. The only difference that a woman could bring a cuckoo into the nest and cheat the rightful chicks. But that could be dealt with by leaving the cuckoo out of your will."
"Is that your considered view, brother?"
"Yes, it is," said Jack, with a look of anguish. "My deepest considered view. I have thought it over again and again. Fair is fair, you know," he said with an attempt at a smile. "I have always felt that very strongly."
"I honour you for it."
"I am glad of that. Some would say it was sad stuff. Yet I do not think you will be so pleased when I tell you I said that if he wished I should go and ask the man in question to give him satisfaction."
"But surely, Jack, there is a contradiction here. Decency, I will not say Christian charity, but at least decency on the one hand, and barbarous heathen revenge on the other."
"Stephen, you have nothing whatsoever to say about barbarous heathen revenge. We both have bloody hands. We have both been out. And if there is an apparent contradiction, I can account for it like this. I deeply know I am right in the first case, and I am almost as certain of it in the second. Did your mathematical studies ever reach to the quadratic equation, Stephen?"
"They did not reach to the far end of the multiplication table."
"The quadratic equation involves the second power of the unknown quantity, but nothing greater, the square."
"Oh, indeed?
My point is this. A quadratic equation has two solutions, and each is right, demonstrably and provably right. There is an apparent, but no real contradiction between the answers.
Stephen felt that he was on dangerous ground. Even if he had not been afraid of giving pain, his mind was so weary that although it teemed with objections, it could barely formulate them.
"Jack," he said in an entirely different voice, having reflected for a while, "you mentioned the Burlings. Will you tell me about them now?"
"Why," said Jack, who understood him perfectly well, "they are that group of rocks, or you might say islands, that rise up sheer out of the sea like mountaintops a little south of the Farallones, some 2 leagues west-northwest of Cape Carvero, in Portugal. They're quite dangerous in thick weather, and many a ship on the Lisbon run has come to grief through not keeping a good offing and a good lookout by night. But they make a capital rendezvous if you don't choose to go over the infernal Tagus Bar, hanging about for high water. And in moderate weather you can lie easy in their lee, fishing over the side for codlings."
He reflected, seeing the Burlings rising high from a warm, calm, Maytime sea.
"When I was a mid in Bellerophon," he said, "the captain sent Mr. Stevens, the master, to survey them, and he took me with him, knowing how I loved that kind of job. He was always very kind to me, or to any young fellow that had a bent for surveying. There is a great satisfaction in triangulation and taking bearing, Stephen."
"I am sure of it."
"I remember some very pretty cross-checks we made, all agreeing exactly, and I remember the enormous clouds of seabirds."
"What sort?"
"Oh, every conceivable sort. You would know their names. The master said that a great many were petrels, I recall, but being startled, they did not fly as petrels usually do, and some had much more white about them than the common kind. They were startled because we pulled into an enormous cave that went on, and in the half-darkness they came flying out almost like black snow. And the cave went on, most uncommon tall overhead, and at last we saw light gleaming round a corner at the other end, for the cave went right through. At the far end the light came more slanting, and we could make out innumerable bats."
"Bats, Jack? You amaze me. Bats, so far from land. You did not take notice of them, I suppose?"
"We were busy taking soundings all the time, but I did notice that some were as big as partridges. Well, quails. And some were small. I'm quite certain that one had long ears. I saw it outlined against the mouth of the cave before it flew off."
"How I longed to spend an hour or two among them. Will you tell me about the surface of the rocks, the vegetation, the places where the birds were sitting? For I presume they had made their nests."
"Certainly they had, and right on top of one another, almost like the people in Seven Dials. But the petrels, as far as I could see, came mostly from the cave. It was full of crevices and ledges and holes."
"What joy! But the vegetation, now, and a very rough description of the fowls themselves?"
They talked on until well after the evening gun, supping together and going back over that voyage to Portugal in the Surprise, during which Stephen would dimly have perceived the Burlings had he been on deck, and in which, after their going ashore at Lisbon, they heard of Sam's being ordained. Sam Pander, Jack's black love child begotten at the Cape. And they were still discussing his chances of a prelacy when the tender came alongside. Jack Aubrey was as solid a Protestant as ever abjured the Pope and the Pretender, but he was deeply attached to Sam, as well he might be, and he was now as expert in the intricacies of the Catholic hierarchy as he was in the succession of admirals. He was speaking eagerly of the Prother Notaries Apostolic and their varying rows of little violet buttons, when Reed came in, took off his hat, and said,
"Tender hooked on, sir, if you please, and all is laid along."
This last, with a significant look at Stephen, meant that Killick had carried over a small valise holding all that he thought proper for Dr. Maturin to wear during this absence, and a supply of shirts.
"Thank you, Mr. Reed," said Stephen.
He hurried into the sleeping cabin that he shared with Jack, put a considerable sum of money into his pocket, and a llama-skin pouch holding his coca leaves and their necessary phial of vegetable ash into his bosom, together with the revolving pistol.
"Farewell, Jack," he said, coming out, fastening his coat. "Pray watch your bowels. There is something a trifle more liverish in your visage than I could wish for. Should nothing occur this evening, desire Mr. Smith to give you rhubarb tomorrow. My dear love to Sophie, of course. I shall be as quick as ever I can, so I shall. God bless now."
The sense of hurried urgency that had been with him ever since he received Sir Joseph's message, at some point now removed by a vast extent of space rather than of time, had revived as he groped his way down the Bellona's side in the darkness, and now its long-frustrated desire was fulfilled, even beyond his hopes. The wind, a strong reefed topsail breeze in the southwest, was kicking up an odd little cross-sea in the harbour, and as Reed, who had brought the Ringle round to face Southsea Castle, filled his forestaysail, leaving the Bellona's towering side and getting under way, the long, low schooner took on a curious fidgeting motion, like a horse held in, dancing on his toes, eager to be off. The gaff rose, the foresail shivering and flattering like an enormous washing day. The sheet came hard aft, and at once the deck leaned sharply, the whole motion changing to a long, slightly pitching glide. She ran straight out of the harbour. Reed and Bondon had spent every spare hour they could, and they handled her beautifully, with love, set her full mainsail and jib, and with Bondon at the helm and Reed at the con, she raced for the ships moored off St. Helens. When Stephen came on deck, he had been desired to go below during these manoeuvres and to stow his belongings as well as he could with so little headroom, she had brought the wind on her starboard quarter. Both great fore and aft sails were drummed tight. She had set her square for topsail as well as everything the forward stays could bear, and now Reed, Bondon, and two elderly Shelmerstonians were wondering whether they might venture upon a weather stunsail. The Shelmerstonians, Mould and Vaggers, were fine examples of what might be called nautical relativity. They were both Sethians and respected members of their congregation, yet neither had ever found any difficulty in reconciling the importation of uncustomed goods with the strictest probity in all personal dealings. And now one was saying that if the stunsail in question had been the King's, he would have risked it without hesitation. But since the clipper was Captain Aubrey's private property, why... And he shook his head. This kind of discussion was neither usual nor encouraged in the Royal Navy, but the present occasion was quite exceptional. Mould and Vaggers, not to put too fine a point upon it, were smugglers, and both their living and their freedom depended on their outsailing the revenue cutters or the faster men of war that tried to detain them. They were the most successful smugglers in Shelmerston, and although they usually sailed in a lugger called the Flying Childers, they had also had great success in a topsail schooner, not indeed as sharp-built as the Ringle, but the fastest in home waters. Their opinion on the stunsail was therefore the opinion of eminent practitioners, and its authority was increased by the fact that they were not sailing again with Captain Aubrey because they needed wages. Far from it, indeed. All those who had shipped with him in the Surprise so long ago, and who had survived, had done so well in prize money that if they wished, they could set up as their own masters. Some preferred wild spending followed by extreme penury, but this was not the case with the serious men of the town, elders, deacons, presbyters of the many sects and chapels, and the reason for the continued presence of Mould, Vaggers, and several of their friends was a revelation, perhaps illusory, certainly ill-timed, to the effect that polygamy was now allowed, and indeed recommended to the Sethians of Shelmerston, a revelation so very ill-conceived by Mrs. Mould and Mrs. Vaggers, to speak only of them, that the Bellona, though a man of war, seemed a haven of peace. Stephen had been aboard the clipper from time to time during their homeward voyage, but in calm weather and in daylight. Now, as he came up the companion ladder onto the dark, steep-sloping deck, he could not recognise his surroundings. Little could he see, and that little was unfamiliar. The great boom of the mainsail, the haze of white, low to leeward, meant nothing to him, and although on consideration he would almost certainly have made out the fundamental difference between fore and aft and square rig, he had no leisure to do so. His groping foot came up against a cleat. A chance caper of the deck flung him off his balance, and he trundled along until he came firmly against one of the Ringle's carronades, to which he clung. They picked him up with the usual sea-going questions. Was he hurt? Did he not know he must always keep one hand for himself and the other for the ship? Why had he not asked one of them to help him? For once he answered rather shortly, which made them stare, the doctor being the meekest of landlubbers, always attentive to good advice and admonition, always grateful for being set on his feet again and, if necessary, helped below. But they were forgiving creatures, and when they understood that their old shipmate wished to stand there, near to what little prow the Ringle could be said to possess, where those sails did not obscure his view, stand there in the dark and the cold, they kindly told him that it would never do, not in this sort of a barkie, which was more what might be called a racing craft
than a Christian schooner, with no more of a bulwark than would keep a kitten aboard. It would never do, without he was made fast to this here stanchion. And so, fast to that there stanchion, he stood, hour after hour. And while one part of his being lived in this great rushing stream of air, with a dead-white bow-wave flying out, flung wide on his right hand, and the black pale-flecked sea racing close below him, the whole in a vast and all-embracing medley of sound, the rest of him peered into the immediate future with all the acuity and concentration that he could bring to bear. Very early his hand had of itself reached for the pouch of coca leaves, but he had deliberately checked the movement. "This I justify, on the grounds that although the present crisis seems to call for all possible clarity of thought and foresight, the leaves should be reserved in case another, even more exigent crisis should arise. But I fear it may be mere superstition, the passionate desire to succeed overwhelming reason entirely, leaving mere sophistry behind." From time to time, Reed or a seaman would come and ask him how he did, or tell him that that was Selsey Bill, or that the breeze was freshening a little. Those were the lights of Worthing, New Shoreham. Well on in the middle watch the stream of tide came more southward, so that great quantities of spindrift, spray, and even green water swept across the low deck. Reed came forward with a cloak over his shoulder and begged Stephen to put it on. "And don't you think, sir," he said, "that you should turn in? On the leeward bow, that is beachy, and round Beachy it will cut up rough. It worries the people to think of you getting soaked." "To tell you the truth, William, I do not mind it at all. Nothing could be more agreeable to my spirit than this all-pervading sense of speed, speed of air, sea, and rushing water. It is so very much more present in a boat like this than in a stolid great ship. Why, sir, we have been clipping along at a very fair pace, 10 knots most of the time, with points of 12. And if the breeze don't die or box the compass, we should have quite a tolerable run. But, sir, would you not step below and take a little something?" The little something was a dish of lobscouse, salt beef, biscuit, onions, potatoes, all pounded or cut up small, stewed close with a good deal of pepper and kept warm between hot bricks, covered with a blanket for the graveyard watch. It went down extraordinarily well with a quart of beer, which they shared in the sea-going manner, passing the pot to and fro without ceremony. "I do not like to tempt fate, sir," said Reed, "but I sometimes think that if only we could catch the early flood, we might make a truly extraordinary run. With never a check between the North Foreland and Sheerness, meeting the first of flood at the Nore and so straight up to London River. Old Mould did it, in the Flying Childers, from off St. Catherine's Point." "That would be very fine, sure, and it would absolutely delight the captain. He thinks the world of this craft, and he means to give her a fine weather suit of the best Riga Paul Davy, including a square running course. Now, if you will excuse me, sir, I believe I must go on deck. Your berth is behind that hanging. Pray try to close an eye." Stephen did so, swimming presently into that series of inconsequential thoughts and half-memories that so often preceded sleep. And he woke from it again in a grey dimness to the sound of a fairly discreet cough, the clink of china, and the smell of coffee. "God be with you, William," he said. "Would that be coffee at all?"
"Which it is, Vaggers, sir," said the seaman with the tray. "The captain is on deck looking at the convoys. You never seen so many wind-bound ships. We are in the Downs.
How is the breeze, Vaggers? And shall we catch our tide?"
"Breeze holds true, sir. But as for the tide, nip and tuck, sir, nip and tuck. Though it will not be Mr. Reed's fault if we miss it. He has been driving the clipper most zealous all night."
He was driving it still when Stephen found him calling for a bonnet to the forestays, but he came over at once with civil inquiries and the assurance that this was not a real lull in the wind, only a slight blanketing from the South Foreland. "We are well in with Deal, as you see," and it would pick up again directly. "And all those poor souls," he said, waving out to sea, to the crowded anchorage of the Downs, "are praying it may drop entirely and come round into the northeast. Some have been windbound for a fortnight and more. It often happens here. That is the West Indies convoy just this side the Gulf Stream. And there, stretching right up to the North Foreland, those are the Mediterranean ships, 100 sail of merchantmen at the very least. And towards the South Goodwin you can make out a group of Indiamen, all praying, no doubt."
"It is not the number that pray, William, but the intensity of the prayer that is offered up. And, of course, its quality,"
said Stephen. "Purely mercantile considerations cannot expect to receive much notice in heaven."
"I'm sure you are right, sir," said Reed.
And he rehearsed the names of the guardian men of war, studying the glum grey sea with its white horses and intermittent showers from the low racing sky.
"Amethyst, Orion, Hercules, Dreadnought," unconsciously using a tone of voice more usual at the altar.
The North Foreland, and the Ringle hauled her wind, heading westward.
"Do you think," asked Stephen at dinner, "that we could be said to be within the estuary of the Thames?"
"I believe we may, sir,"
said Reed, happy though red-eyed from want of sleep.
"And I believe we may almost say, though I touch wood, that we are not very likely to miss our tide."
The Nore, and presently it became apparent, even to Dr. Maturin, that the schooner's motion had changed, that she had, in fact, caught her tide, and that the first hint of the making flood was carrying her on a living stream. The remote shore, visible now on either side, drew somewhat closer, and after a while Reed handed over to Mould, disappointed as a polygamous patriarch, but the best Thames pilot among them. Mould told Stephen a great deal about the official men, all to their discredit, and presently he pointed out Muck Flat on the northern shore, where a Trinity House branch pilot had run him aground in the year 92.
"Well, might you have called it Muck Flat by the time we had served him out?"
Although the breeze, the river, and even those that used the river, including the heavy, slow, awkward, and inclined to be abusive Thames barges that felt they had priority over all the other craft in the stream, behaved well through that long, winding day, Mould was in a sombre mood. Towards evening, when between showers the sky cleared beautifully, showing Greenwich in all its splendour, shining white and green on the river bank, he jerked his chin in that direction and said,
"Greenwich, you would not believe, sir, the amount of money they screw out of poor hard-working seafaring men for that old chest of theirs. And whoever seen a penny piece out of it? Not old Mould, any gate."
"Lo, Greenwich, where many a shrew is in," said Stephen, unthinking.
"Greenwich is bad enough, bad enough. There are some very disagreeable females in Greenwich. But it is nothing at all," said Mould,
his voice rising passionately as he caused the stout tiller to tremble under his hand.
"Nothing at all, set against Shelmerston for shrews. Take Mrs. Mould, for instance."
He took Mrs. Mould, and handled her most severely, not only for her ignorant, illiberal, worldly rejection of the plurality of wives.
"Think of Abraham, sir. Think of Solomon. Remember Gideon? 70 sons and many wives."
But also for a variety of shortcomings that it would scarcely be decent to name, all denounced with such vehemence that it would have been necessary to check him if a lighter, more or less guided by an idiot boy with a single enormous oar, had not drifted across the Ringle's bows, so that her topsail was obliged to be backed at once to take the way off her, and all sheets let fly, with every soul that could seize a spar fended off in an uproar of reprobation. It was as though the din stunned both tide and breeze, for when at length the wretched lighter slanted off towards the farther shore, the Ringle no longer answered her helm, but slowly turned upon herself, facing the way she had come. For this was now slack water, and presently the ebb would begin. Happily the calm was only the respite caused by the setting of the sun, and the reviving breeze carried them well up into the pool before the downward current had gathered any real strength. Here, to the relief of all hands, they dropped anchor. Reed looked at his watch, laughed aloud, and gave the formal order,
"Pipe to supper!"
There was a fair amount of traffic on the river, ship visiting among the scores of merchantmen, citizens going about their business, parties of pleasure dropping down to Greenwich. And when he and the jubilant Reed had eaten their meal, a capon and a bottle of claret brought from the King's Head to celebrate their wonderful passage, Stephen hailed a passing wherry, which carried him to the Temple stairs. But at Mr. Lawrence's chambers he was confronted by a startled clerk, who said that Mr. Lawrence was not in the way. Nobody had looked to see the doctor for at least 2 days, and Mr. Lawrence had gone out of town, would not be back until tomorrow. Late tomorrow. He would be so sorry to have missed the doctor.
"He will not miss me at all," said Stephen. "I shall sleep at an inn called The Grapes in the Liberties of the Savoy, and I shall spend the early part of tomorrow buying various things and seeing friends. I shall dine at my club, which Mr. Lawrence knows. I shall leave a message at The Grapes and at Black's to say where I can be found, if by any chance he should come back sooner than he expects. Otherwise I shall come here at the same time in the evening."
"Very well, sir,"
"'And may I add, sir,' said the clerk in an undertone, "'that the goods have been looked after.'
Stephen was too late to find Sarah and Emily still up, but Mrs. Broad gave him a most satisfactory account of their happiness, and they breakfasted with him in the morning, grinding the coffee themselves, bringing toast, kippers, marmalade, describing the wonders of London, perpetually interrupting one another, perpetually breaking off to ask whether he remembered Lima and the splendid organ there, the street lined with silver, the mountains and the snow, the green ice off Cape Horn. "'Mrs. Broad,' he said on leaving the grapes, "'if anyone should call from Mr. Lawrence's chambers, be so good as to say that I shall be at Clementi's Pianoforte Warehouse until about 3, and after that at my club.' No message did, in fact, appear, but the time passed agreeably with Mr. Hinksey, whom he met at Clementi's, and who, after they had dined together at Black's, walked back with Stephen as far as the Temple Bar. Lawrence was touchingly pleased to see him, obviously feeling very much more concerned than his mere duty as Stephen's legal adviser required.
"'I am so very glad you have taken our advice,' he said. "'Come in, come in. This is as disagreeable and potentially dangerous a situation as ever I have known. In here, if you please.' "'Forgive these papers and the cake. How happy I am that you are here. I had scarcely looked for you until tomorrow. You posted up, I presume?'
"'I came by boat,' said Stephen. "'By sea,' he added, observing that his words had no effect whatsoever.
"'Ah, indeed,' said Lawrence,
for whom this astonishing fact was clearly much the same as a trip from Richmond or Hampton Court. "'A packet, no doubt?'
"'No, sir, a private tender belonging to Mr. Aubrey, a vessel of astonishing powers of sailing.' No other could have brought us to the Pool of London itself in a number of hours that escapes me for the moment, but that filled my shipmates with admiration and astonishment.
So you have it yet, this boat, and in the pool? So much the better. Pray sit down. How very glad I am to see you. I have been growing anxious. Allow me to cut you a piece of cake. They sat at the crumb-covered table, and Lawrence fetched another glass.
This is the Madeira you sent me a couple of years ago, he said.
They settled, drinking their wine and eating their cake, collecting themselves and, as it were, breathing.
"'Sir Lawrence brought me the documents, signed,' said Lawrence. "'I am most obliged to you for your confidence.'
"'I am infinitely more obliged to you for your advice and your help,' said Stephen.
Lawrence bowed and went on.
"'I gave the bank formal warning within the hour, and then I sent for Pratt. Physical transfers of treasure call for a certain discretion at all times, even more so now and in this case.' I have been growing more anxious, as I say, and Pratt shared my anxiety. We neither of us have heard anything definite, but we have both heard of fresh consultations on the part of Habakstall's main lawyers, and of violent, indeed murderous, disagreements among those criminals he has so imprudently employed as his agents.
He poured more wine and said, I have taken it upon myself to spend some hundreds of your guineas.
Of course, you could not oblige me more.
Pratt, who understands these things better than any man I know, caused your chests to be repacked in large cases marked Double Refined Platina and removed to a lead, brass and copper warehouse on the river by Iron Gate Stairs, where they can lie until you make arrangements to carry them away elsewhere. Or perhaps to ship them. I do not know your plans, of course. Is the tender of which you speak a ship or a little pleasure boat?
It is scarcely what the mariners would describe as a ship, but it is a commodious little vessel capable of a circumnavigation, and the dear knows, I have carried more in less.
It was no new thing for Dr. Maturin's shipmates to load singular cargoes aboard the vessels he sailed in, giant squids on occasion, or little iron-bound chests of extraordinary weight. He was, and always had been, a singular gent, but they were used to his little ways. It was known that he carried out learned scientific and political tasks for government, and although they were a little puzzled by the grim bruisers and former Bow Street runners who supervised the operation, they took no umbrage, and stowed the Double Refined Platina so that it would bring the clipper a trifle by the stern, and they were preparing to cast off in the first light when it was found that Arthur Mould was missing.
"'Ain't he back yet?' asked Bondon.
The other Sethians shook their heads, looking down.
"'Joe,' said Bondon to the youngest member of the crew, "'cut along to Bedmaid Lane, first on the left going downstream. Knock on the door number 6, a great big 6 in red, and ask for Mr. Gideon Mould. The barkey awaits his pleasure.'
"'His pleasure? That's right, Cock,' said several of his mates. "'What a cove he is, that old Mould. He can't leave it alone.'
Mould, glum now, penniless and anxious about the possible outcome of his repeated joys, returned. The Ringle hoisted her jib, shoved off from the wharf, and stood out into the midstream at half ebb, with a stiff breeze on her starboard beam, followed by a cry from a black man in a crimson gig.
"What ho, the Baltimore Clipper, oh!"
When all was settled, and the river somewhat broader, less crowded, Reed found Stephen in the cabin and said,
"Would you please look at the logbook, sir? I've wrote it fair."
"Very fair it is, too, upon my faith," said Stephen, looking at the neat column of dates, winds, and remarks.
"And here, sir, you see the exact minute of our dropping anchor in the pool. Please would you sign, small and neat, in the margin, with all the degrees you can think of, and FRS as well? They will never believe me else."
Stephen signed, and Reed, having gloated over the entry for a while, said,
"And don't we wish we may do the same going back?"
"Oh, no, not at all. Still, she's by the stern now, near half a strake, which is some comfort."
"In what way is it a comfort, William?"
"Why, sir, she will beat to windward just that trifle better." Seeing the blank stupidity on the doctor's face, he added, "Had you not noticed it is still in the west-southwest?"
"I thought it was on our flank, the wind, our broadside, our starboard beam," said Stephen. "I particularly noticed it when my hat blew off. But then no doubt it is we that have turned rather than the breeze, or indeed I may even say tempest. Do you suppose that we may be wind-bound like those unhappy convoys in the Downs, the sorrow and woe?"
"Oh, no, sir, I hope not. I dare say the breeze will have changed by then. I have no doubt of it, indeed, from the tingling in my wound." But for all Reed's tingling, he had been wounded in the arm during an action with Dyaks in the East Indies, and Stephen had had to take it off. It was still blowing strong from the west-south-west as they passed the Nore again in the falling dusk. And all the way along from the North Foreland, the whole length and breadth of the Downs glittered with the riding lights of ships lying there with two or three cables ahead, wind-bound still, with many new arrivals. The wind grew stronger with the progress of the night, and in the middle watch, four ships drove upon the Goodwin Sands. The following week was among the most disagreeable that Stephen had ever known. Evening after evening promised relief, and every time the sun went down the promise proved false. There were slightly less dangerous lulls in the day, usually about noon, and a few hardy deal boats would come out, trade at famine prices along the more sheltered merchantmen, and then put in downwind at Ramsgate. But even these were sometimes wrecked. Some days after the squadron must have sailed, for even Dr. Maturin could see the ships lying off St. Helens had a west-south-west wind on the beam, rather than in their teeth, like the unfortunate souls in the Downs, he embarked in one of these deal boats for Ramsgate, half determined to post across country to Barham. But sitting there in a music shop and reflecting, he found that the uncertainties were too great. This was an enterprise that had to be carried out in one smooth sequence, easily or not at all, no wavering, no hesitation. There must be no Ringle arrived independently at a time unknown, no indiscreet, loquacious messengers blundering about, no indefinite waiting, no widely aroused public curiosity.
"Now, sir, if you please," said the shopman, "I fear I must put up my shutters. There is an auction at Deal that I must attend."
"Very well," said Stephen. "Then I shall take this," holding up Haydn's Symphonie Funèbre, "if you will be so good as to wrap it thoroughly, for I too must ride back to Deal to regain my ship."
"In that case, sir, pray come with me in my taxi cart. I will fold the score into a double piece of oilskin, for I am afraid you will have but a wet trip in the boat."
From this point until Saturday, he returned to his coca leaves, feeling that the din alone, the incessant though varied howling, shrieking and moaning of the wind, the perpetual thunder of the seas, justified the measure quite apart from mental distress. He found that they had one very curious and unexpected effect. For whereas ordinarily he was a poor and hesitant reader of an orchestral score, he could now hear almost the entire band playing away together at his first run through the pages, not far from perfectly at the second and third. And of course the leaves also did what he had relied upon them to do, clarifying his mind, diminishing anxiety, largely doing away with hunger and sleep. Yet on the third day he was aware of the impression that they were doing these things not to Stephen Maturin, but to a somewhat inferior, apathetic, uninterested man who, though cleverer in some ways, thought Haydn of no great consequence.
"Can it be that I am over-indulging?" he asked,
as he counted the leaves to ascertain his usual dose. Or may the incessant and violent pitching be the cause of this dismal change, the loss of joy?
Doctor, cried William Reed, breaking in on his thoughts, this time I believe we can really hope. The glass has risen.
Other vessels had noticed this. Many an anxious eye had been fixed upon the barometer, and now there was a certain amount of activity in the road. But the wind was still too strong and too dead foul for any of the ships, the square-rigged ships, to think of moving in these narrow waters, though it gave signs of veering into the west and even north of west. About noon, a hoy, intently watched by the few other fore-and-aft-rigged vessels in the Downs, got under way. For the first moments a squall hid her from the Ringall's deck, and when it had passed she was seen to have carried away her sprit. Her foresail had blown out of its bolt-rope, and she was driving helplessly through the lines of shipping, fouling many a hawser, cursed by all within earshot. In the afternoon watch Bondon, coming below on a more or less convincing pretext, said to Reed,
"As I dare say you know, sir, some of our people were free traders at one time. In course they are reformed characters now, and would scorn an uncustomed keg of brandy or chest of tea, but they remember what they learnt in them wicked days. Molden Vaggers were once in this very spot with just such a blow in their topsail schooner, and they say with a breeze not half a point west of this there is a passage at high tide for a very weatherly craft. They took it, being in a hurry. They passed between the Hammer and Anvil, cleared the Downs, and so beat down channel as light as a fairy and put into Shelmerston the next day for supper, having met their friends off Greenay. And their barkie," he added, gazing at the horizon, "was not as weatherly as ours."
Reed did not reply at once. Like many other midshipmen, he had carried prizes into ports, but he had never had such a voyage as this, still less such a vessel. For half an hour he watched the weather gauge, and when it showed half a point in their favour, he called for Mould and Vaggers.
"Mould and Vaggers," he said in a deep, formal voice, "with this breeze, and at this state of the tide, could you undertake to pilot the tender through the passage?"
"Yes, sir,"
they said, but they would have to look sharp. The ebb would start in half an hour. The Ringalls looked sharp. They were sick and tired of being rattled about like dried peas in a can, and they were very willing to show those lubbers in the Downs how seamen of the better sort dealt with situations of this kind. They won their anchors, hoisted a scrap of the jib, set the close-reefed mainsail, and edged away through the shipping. Mould was at the helm with three turns round the tiller, Vaggers and two friends at the mainsheet. There was a great deal of white water over the face of the sea, and with the beginning of ebb breakers showed wider on the edge of the sands. They were steering for a particular shoal, and already the sequence that gave this shoal its name was beginning to show. A roller would break on the right hand, shooting up a column of water that at low tide and with a strong swell and following wind would be flung across a 20-yard channel, falling with a loud dead thump on the flat sand the other side. The Anvil. So far the Hammer was no more than a little 10-foot fountain, but the men's faces were tense as they approached it, for immediately after it came a dogleg in the channel that had to be judged to the yard. They were between Hammer and Anvil. The little fountain rose, sprinkling Stephen and Reed.
"Ready about?" said Mould. "Helms alight!"
The schooner stayed to perfection, a smooth turn with never a check. Mould held her so, very close to the wind for a moment, during which she forged somewhat ahead, and then let her fall off. They were through, clear of the Narrows, clear of the Downs. And now, for a craft as weatherly as the Ringall, with plenty of sea room, it was only a matter of a dozen long reaches for home. Stephen Maturin, the clock of his appetite much disordered by the use of coca leaves, a strictly moderate use now, however, with the dose being administered to a person wholly recognisable as himself, walked into the dining-room at Barham while the meal was in full progress. That is to say, when Clarissa had cracked the shell of her second boiled egg. She was not a woman much given to shrieks or exclamations, but she was not wholly above commonplace reaction, and now she uttered a great, "Oh!" and quickly asked him, was it he, and had he come back, before recovering herself, sitting down again and suggesting that he should have something to eat. An omelette was a matter of minutes, no more.
"Thank you, my dear. I dined on the road," said Stephen, giving her a peck on each cheek. "What a pleasant table this is," he went on as he sat down at her side.
He had inherited an absurd amount of silver from his godfather, most of it Peruvian, sober, almost severe, and a gleaming river ran down the whole length.
"It is to celebrate the day I left New South Wales," said Clarissa. "Will you not take a glass of wine, at least?"
"I might, too," said Stephen. "A glass of wine would go down very well. But listen, my dear, we must be off to Spain within the hour, so when you have eaten your egg, and may it prosper you, perhaps you would put just what you and Bridget will need for the voyage."
Clarissa looked at him gravely, with a spoon poised between her egg and her mouth. But before she could speak, there was a thundering on the stairs and in the corridor, and Padine and Bridget burst in. Padine began a long stammering word that might have been chaise, but that never came to an end. Bridget cried out, "Horses!" in English, and then, seeing Stephen, both fell silent, amazed. After a pause of no more than half of a breath, Padine took Bridget by the hand and led her up to him. She looked at Stephen with a shy but quite open interest, even a smile, and slightly prompted, she said in a clear, high Irish,
"God and Mary be with you, my father,"
holding up her face. He kissed it and said,
"God and Mary and Patrick be with you, my daughter. We are all going to Spain, the joy and delight."
Padine explained that they had been in the high back room netting a hammock before Bridget should be brought down for her pudding, when they saw the Royal William's chaise come into the stable yard with two horses they knew, Norman and Hamilton, and two horses they did not, borrowed no doubt from the Nolder Arms. Mrs. Warren brought in the pudding, flustered and upset by all this activity. She tied the child's bib rather sharply, squaring her in her chair, clapped the pudding down, common, quaking pudding, and said to Clarissa,
"The post boys say they are to water their horses and walk them up and down for an hour, no more. Am I to give them something to eat?"
"Bread, cheese, and a pint of beer for each," said Clarissa. "My dear Bridget, you are not to play with your food. What will your father think?"
Bridget had indeed been beating her pudding to make it quake in earnest, but she stopped at once and hung her head. After a while she whispered in Irish,
"Would you like a little piece?"
"A very little piece, if you please," said Stephen.
He contemplated Clarissa as she finished her egg.
"How I value that young woman for not asking questions," he reflected. "It is true that she is used to naval ways and to leaving home, family, kittens, doves, pot plants, at a moment's notice. No tide must ever be missed, God forbid. But I am convinced that she does not need to ask. She understood the essentials when first our eyes met."
All this he had known or strongly surmised at some level. The child, on the other hand, left him astonished, completely taken aback, at an enchanted loss. He had hoped and prayed, with more than 100 weight of candles judiciously shared among 53 saints, for some perceptible progress. But now, and virtually at once, the child was living an outward life. She finished her pudding, and showing her bare scraped plate, she asked if she might get down. She did so want to go and look at the chaise close to and touch it. This was in English, of a sort, but then in a quiet and, as it were, confidential Irish, she said to Stephen,
"And should you like to be shown the chaise and four?"
"Honey, am I not after coming in it? It is warm with my warmth, like a chair, and we shall all set off in an hour, no more, when I have drunk up my coffee."
The child laughed aloud.
"And may the Padine and I sit on the little small seat high up behind, on the dickey?"
she asked.
"Oh, such happiness!"
Clarissa had never accumulated much in the way of personal property. Once she put her head in at the door and asked,
"Is it cold?" "Bitter cold in the winter," said Stephen. "But never trouble your mind. We shall buy a suitable garment in Corunna, Avila, or Madrid itself. Take something against the wet in the north, however, and half-boots."
He had barely had time to deal with the aged groom and the women servants, paying them down 6 months' board wages, giving instructions for the care of the livestock and the renewal of the laundry boiler, a bill that Mrs. Aubrey would pay, before Padine reported,
"On stored aboard and roped, sir, and may the Bradine and I sit on the little small...
"You may," said Stephen,
walking out of the house. He opened the carriage door for Clarissa, called,
"Bless you all,"
to the servants gathered on the steps, and "Give way," to the postboys. The carriage rolled off.
"Will I explain the position?" asked Stephen. "Padine and I have been betrayed?"
"Just so."
"Yes, there have been inquiries in the village. Odd-looking men along the lane and even in the stable-yard."
It all turns on a question of revenge against me. The pardons I had asked for, the quite usual pardons for you and Padine in a case like this, were not refused, but they were held up, delayed, and delayed by ill will. They will be granted, I believe, and quite soon, but until then we are all much better out of the country, out of my enemy's reach. In any case, I should like to have Bridget under the care of Dr. Liers, who has had more success with children of her kind than any man in Europe. Not, the dear God be thanked, beyond measure, that she seems to need the care of any medical man at all. The changes of the nature one usually associated with miracles alone. It is utterly beyond my comprehension, said Clarissa. Nothing I have ever known has given me such happiness. Day after day, like a flower opening. She prattled for quite a while with Padine and the animals, and now she does so with me and the maids. A little shy of English at first. To begin with, she spoke it only to the cats and the sow. Stephen laughed with pleasure, an odd grating sound, and after a while he said, She will learn Spanish, too, Castellano. I'm sorry it will not be Catalan, a much finer, older, purer, more mellifluous language, with far greater writers. Think of En Ramon Llull. But as Captain Aubrey often says, you cannot both have a stitch in time and eat it. I mean to take you, or rather to send you under escort, since I cannot leave the ship, to the Benedictine house in Avila, where an aunt of my father's is abbess, and where Dr. Liers will be at hand. It is the easiest and kindest of disciplines there. The nuns are gentlewomen, and several of them, and the pensioners, are English of the old Catholic families, or Irish. They have an excellent choir, and the convent owns three of the finest vineyards in Spain. I intend Padine to go with you as your servant, and as a continual source of springing life for Bridine. You will not be lonely there, and though your life may be rather dull, it will be safe. I ask no more, said Clarissa. The chaise was on the smooth road now, not far from the turning to Ashgrove Cottage, and Bridget's voice could be heard exclaiming at the huge, enormous great haycocks, bigger than she had ever seen in her life. Shall we have time to call on Mrs. Aubrey to take leave? Said Clarissa. It would surely be most improper to vanish with never a word. It would also look like a low-minded resentment.
We shall not, said Stephen. Even as things are, the tide will be half out. There is not a moment to be lost.
He reflected, and presently he repeated the word resentment in a questioning tone. Yes, said Clarissa, it was almost unfortunate. She has very kindly come to see Bridget and me from time to time, and a little while ago she sent a note saying she had a letter from Captain Aubrey in London with some news about my pension as an officer's widow, and might she call, since a friend of Diana's had given us a present of venison, and since it was full moon and she all alone, I asked her to dinner, together with Dr. Hamish and Mr. Hinksey, our parson. We laid things out with some degree of splendour. Even that dreadful Killick could hardly have done better than Padine, and I put on my very best dress. It was that glorious crimson Java silk which Captain Aubrey gave me to be married in. Stephen nodded. He remembered the incident perfectly. The cutting of a bolt of cloth that Jack Aubrey had bought from a Chinese merchant in Batavia with the help of the governor's wife.
Yes, but Mrs. Aubrey walked in wearing exactly the same stuff, cut a little more full and gathered here, but exactly the same magnificent red. We stared at one another like a couple of ninnies, and before either of us could say anything, the men arrived, first Hinksey and then the doctor. But I knew with absolute certainty, as though it had been printed on her forehead, that she thought Aubrey had given me the cloth for services rendered, and that she had come off with a fag-end of his mistress's leavings. The food was pretty good, as I remember. The wine was of your choosing. We drank an ancient Chambertin with the venison, and from time to time she remembered her manners and added something to the general talk, but it was no good. The dinner, one of the few I have ever given, was a complete failure. Bridget was brought in when Mrs. Aubrey and I went to the drawing-room, so there was no possibility of explanation, even if I had felt inclined to make any, which by then I most certainly did not. Fortunately, the men did not sit long over their wine, so the evening soon came to its miserable end. That is what I mean by resentment.
Stephen nodded.
There is nothing to say, only that I very deeply regret the unhappiness, all of it unnecessary.
We are descending towards the sea.
The sea! The sea!
Cried Bridget, leaping about in an ecstasy as they went down the shore to the waiting boat.
Oh, what a wonderful sea!
This was her first sight of it, and she was luckier than most. The tide was half out, and from the harbour mouth a small swell sent in a series of waves that broke in white fan after fan on the pure, hard sand. The water itself was a living blue-green, perfectly clear.
Very high overhead rode a sky of no determinate colour, crowded with towering cumulus. On the other hand, the bay curved out in tawny cliffs, while from behind Shelmerston the remote and setting sun sent a warm, diffused, calm, even and comfortable light. She broke away, seizing three strands of sea tangle and a piece of green, fresh, curling weed, thrust them into her bosom and ran back.
"How do you do, sir?"
she said to Bondon, offering her hand, and the boat's crew welcomed her with infinite benevolence.
"Let the doctor's little maid sit up in the bows," said Mould, and they passed her from hand to hand until she was perched on his folded jersey, calling out with delight as the boat shoved off.
"Mrs. Oakes, ma'am, you are very welcome aboard," said Reed, helping her up the side. "And you too, my dear. Doctor, sir, you have caught your tide as pretty as could be. I had scarcely started looking at my watch. Ma'am, how I hope you have an appetite. Our friends in the town have brought us the noblest souls that ever yet were seen."
He showed them below, begging them to mind their heads, and returned to the deck. The usual sounds followed their usual sequence. The cable coming aboard, the anchor being catted and fished, the boat ran up to the davits, then even a moderately practised ear could make out the sound of halyards in their blocks, and the deck leaned over under their feet. The ship was filled with a universal living sound, a vibration.
"It is moving, we are!" cried Bridget.
She escaped from the cabin and ran up on deck.
"I must not behave like an old foolish mother hen," thought Stephen.
But he followed her, nevertheless, and sitting abaft the tiller, he watched her risk life and limb, very gently restrained in her wilder excesses by Padine and the seamen, kind and endlessly patient. At one point he saw her ascend to the four cross-trees, clinging to the rough and scaly neck of old Mould. She was the ideal traveller, indefatigable, delighted with everything, and though the Ringle met a fine west-south-west swell when she was clear of the land, a swell that cut up somewhat on meeting the tide, she felt not the slightest qualm, nor, apparently, fear of any kind. She did not mind getting wet either, which was just as well, since the Ringle was sailing due southwest with the breeze 2 points free and the choppy seas were coming aboard in packets over the starboard bow, soaking her at regular intervals as she clung to the foremast shrouds, each packet, green or white, being signalled by a delighted shriek. Eventually, with darkness gathering, she was brought aft and below, dried, put down in front of a bowl of lobscouse, the Ringle's only dish apart from skilligalee or burgoo, and desired to "tuck in, mate, tuck in like a good'un." After two spoons she fell fast asleep, her head on the table, one hand still clutching a gnawed ship's biscuit, so fast asleep that she was obliged to be carried off, perfectly limp, sponged more or less, and lashed into a small hammock.
"Well, sir," said Reed at supper, "we could not have asked for a more prosperous breeze. This craft fairly loves the wind afore the beam, and we have been making 10 knots ever since we passed the start, with no more than what you see, no dimity, no gaff topsails even. I did suggest cracking on, ma'am, to show you just what she could do, but they would have none of it. There was no actual downright mutiny, just disapproving looks and shaking heads, and I was told it was felt the barkey should sail sweet, this being the little maid's first trip. Though I must say I do not think she would turn a hair if we were scudding under bare poles in danger of being pooped every other minute. Now, ma'am, a trifle of this apple tart. The carpenter's wife sent it down, one for his mess and one for ours, which I take very kind. The merest trifle, if you please. I love a good apple tart, and this one looks superb. But I am so sleepy that I am liable to disgrace myself and fall over sideways. It is no doubt the effect of the sea air."
No doubt at all. The sea air did the same for all three passengers, who did not stir until the sun was well up, when they appeared heavy-eyed, pale and stupid, no one any better than the rest.
"Good morning, sir," cried Reed, offensively bright. "What a brilliant day! We had a wonderful run in the night, and close in by Ushant we spoke the Briseis. Old Beaumont, you remember old Beaumont in the Worcester, sir, was the officer of the watch, and he said some of the offshore squadron had exchanged signals with a commodore on Thursday, standing southwest under an easy sail. But, sir, I dare say you would like your breakfast. What will the little girl take?"
"What indeed? Mrs. Oakes," he called, "pray what are children fed on?"
"Milk," said Clarissa.
The Ringle's people looked tolerably blank, and discipline aboard a private tender under a midshipman not being as rigid as it might have been in a ship of the line, they freely exchanged their views.
"If only I had thought," said Slade. "I should have brought a pailful along, and a pot of cream."
"Cheese is particularly good for young female bones," said the yeoman of the sheets. "My cousin Sturgis would have lent us his goat."
In the end it was decided that if ship's biscuit and small beer were rejected, and Mrs. Oakes rejected both out of hand, then skilligalee was their only resource. Bridget therefore faced a bowl of very thin oatmeal gruel, sweetened with sugar and tempered with butter. She thought it the finest dish she had ever eaten, a more-than-birthday indulgence. She ate it up with naked greed and begged for more, and when at last she was told that she might get down, skipped about the deck singing,
"Skilligalee, skilligaloo, skilligalee, yo-hoo-hoo-hoo,"
with a persistence that only very good-natured men could have borne, as the Ringles did, until dinner changed the course of her mind. This being Thursday, she and all hands were allowed a pound of salt pork and half a pint of dried peas. A gallon of beer would also have made part of her ration, but she was advised not to insist upon it. The breeze freshened in the afternoon. They took a reef in the foresail and the main, and the Ringle was filled with that happy sense of making a good passage. 10 knots, 10 2 fathoms, 11 knots, sir, if you please, watch after watch, and Bridget spent all her time in the bows, watching the schooner rise on the now much longer swell, race down, and split the next crest at great speed, flinging the spray to leeward in the most exhilarating fashion, always the same, always new. Once a line of porpoises crossed their hawse, rising and plunging like a single long black serpent, and once Stephen showed her a petrel, a little fluttering blackbird that pitted on the white traces of broken waves. But otherwise the day was made up of strong, diffused light, racing clouds with blue between, a vast grey sea, the continuous rush of wind and water, and a freshness that pervaded everything.
"You was born with sea legs, my dear," said Slade, as she came careering aft for supper.
"I shall never go ashore," she replied.
But Ian slipped easily back into his place as a seaman, an ordinary seaman, for he did not possess the countless particular skills required to be rated able. Skills he had, and many of them, but they were all to do with the land, he being profoundly a peasant by breeding and inclination. Yet he was seaman enough to be perfectly at home aboard, and in the morning watch on Thursday Stephen found him fishing for mackerel in the Ringle's bows. It was still long before dawn, moderately thick weather with occasional showers, thunder out to sea, a long even swell, the wind quite strong in the west-northwest. The schooner had been making long, long boards, beating steadily into it, and now she was on the starboard tack close in with the land, with the iron-bound northern coast of Spain hitherto unseen. Well ahead on the larboard bow, the Vares light, high on the cape that ran far out to sea, showed fiery orange when it was not obscured by the squalls, and it was said that this light attracted the fish so often to be found within this bay. Whether this was so or not, the middle watch had caught a fine basketful, and that was why the clipper had lingered a little longer on this tack, drawing somewhat closer to the shore. She was under reefed fore and mainsails, with the jib half in, easily stemming the tide, which ran fast round the cape, but making no great way with regard to the land.
"You have not gone to bed, I find," he said.
"Nor have I, indeed," said Padine. "At the end of the watch I began thinking about the man that betrayed us, the informer, the Judas, and what with the fury and the dread of being sent back to Botany Bay, there was no sleep in me at all."
"The back of my hand to the informer," said Stephen. "Hell is filled with them 17 deep. They are—"
He was cut short by a triple flash of lightning and an almost simultaneous thunderclap over the cliff to leeward.
"There," he went on, "there is the coast of Spain itself."
Still more lightning showed it clear,
and once you have set foot in that country, no man can take you up and send you back to that infamous place. In any event, I am confident that within the year I shall get you your pardon, and then you can go wherever you please. But, Padine, for the present I wish you to go with Bridget and Mrs. Oakes to Avila in Spain to look after them. They are to live there in a convent where many other ladies stay with the nuns. And listen, now, Padine, if you look after them faithfully for a year and a day, you shall have a small farm I own in Munster near Cheyenne Nagher in the County Clare, with 17 acres, 17 Irish acres, of moderate land. It has a house with a slate roof, and at present there are 3 cows and an ass, pigs, of course, and 2 hives of bees, and it has the right to cut 17 loads of turf on the bog. Are you content, Padine?"
"I am content, Your Honour, your discretion," said Padine in a trembling voice. I should look after the Bradeen for 1,000 years and a day for nothing at all. But oh, how I should love some land itself. My grandfather once owned nearly 3 acres and rented 2 more.
They talked about the land, the pleasures of farming, the delight of seeing things grow, of reaping and threshing. Or rather, Padine talked, such a clear torrent of words as Stephen had not heard from him before. And the day broke quite suddenly, the clouds tearing away in the first gleam of dawn.
"All hands! All hands!" roared Bonden right aft,
and he and others ran beating on the hatches.
"All hands! All hands on deck!"
Padine, easily amazed, tripped Stephen with his rod and his basket of fishes, and before they had recovered, Reed was on deck in his nightshirt giving orders. Half a mile astern, in the bay closed by Cape Varies, lay a 3-masted lugger, long, low and black. She was heavily armed and heavily manned. She was already increasing sail. Padine had instantly run to his station at the foresheet. Stephen took up a post on the starboard quarter, where he was reasonably out of the way. He could hear the rapid exchanges between Reed and the men whose opinion he asked, and he caught the hands' words as they worked or stood by. All agreed that the lugger was a Frenchman out of Douarnenez called the Marie-Paul. Very fast. The revenue cutters had never caught her. Sometimes a privateer. Privateer now, for certain, sure. So full of hands. They might spare a Brixham trawler, but no one else. Christian, Turk, or Jew. And Francois, the skipper, was a right bastard. A brass 9-pounder in the bows they served most uncommon well. All hands spoke very seriously, and they looked grave. He could not see Reed's expression. He was at the tiller with Bonden, and his back was turned. But Bonden's was firm set, composed. Looking fore and aft, Stephen assessed the position, the light strengthening every minute and the clipper heeling more and more as the sheets were hauled and belayed right aft. As far as his sea-going experience went, there was no way out. A short mile ahead, Cape Varies ran north into the sea. They could not clear its tip on this starboard tack. They must go about to gain an offing, and as they did so, the big lugger must necessarily board them. She was coming up fast, full-packed with men. Many a sea chase had he known, as either hunter or quarry, and they had all been long, sometimes very long, a matter of days, with the tension great yet sustained, as it were spread out and more nearly bearable. Now it was to be a matter of minutes rather than hours or days. The clipper, her lee rail buried in foam and a cloud of sail abroad, was already making 10 knots, and she must either strike that cape in 4 minutes or go about and receive the lugger on her starboard beam. As these minutes passed, he realized, with an extraordinary intensity, just what his fortune, lying in its chests below, meant to him and his daughter, and to 1,000 aspects of his life. It had not occurred to him that money could have such value, that he could prize it so much. Gulls drifted between the Ringle and the Cape, waves breaking along its shore. He turned a haggard face to the men at the helm, and as though he felt the look, Reed glanced back at him. The young man's expression had something of that happy wildness Stephen had often seen in Jack Aubrey at times of crisis, and smiling he called, "Stand by, Doctor! Watch out!" adding some words to Slade about a biscuit. Then he and Bonden, their hands on the triple-turned rope and the tiller, their eyes fixed to the leech of the foresail, eased the helm a lee, and still more a lee. Stephen saw the dreadful shore of the Cape, now so close, racing away to the left. He saw its seaward end appear just clear of the larboard bow, at 10 yards, perhaps. He heard young Reed cry, "Toss it hard!" Slade flung the biscuit, hit the rock, and in a roar of laughter they were passed, round into the open sea. The lugger fired an ineffectual gun and tacked, incapable of weathering the Cape, losing ground, impetus, and her prize. The pursuit continued for some hours, but by noon the lugger was hull down in the east, hopelessly outsailed. The Ringle carried on in a state of extraordinary good humour, often laughing, often reminding one another that they had weathered that old Cape Varies within biscuit toss. Some tried to explain their triumph to Mrs. Oakes and Bridget, but although they conveyed their happiness and sense of good fortune, they had not fully succeeded before the Ringle opened the port of Corunna, or as some said, the groin. As Stephen stood in the bows, smiling at the busy harbour and the town, Mould sidled casually up to him, and out of the corner of his mouth he said, "Me and my mates know the groin as well as we know Shelmerston. This is where we used to come for our brandy. And if so be you would like to have the goods landed discreet, as I might say, we know a party, dead honest, or he would have been scragged long since, that might answer."
"Thank you, Mould. Thank you very much for your kind suggestion. But this time, eh? I mean to land them in all legality. And that is what I'm going to tell the captain of the port and his people. But I am very much obliged to you and your friends for your goodwill." Some hours later, Stephen, sitting in the cabin with a perfectly mute Reed and two senior port authorities, said, "And apart from the martial stores belonging to this vessel, the tender to His Britannic Majesty's ship Bellona, that you saw so recently, none of which constitutes merchandise, there is nothing except some treasure belonging to me personally, which I mean to lodge with the Bank of the Holy Ghost and of Commerce in this city. I am acquainted with Don José Ruiz, its director, who shipped it to me in the first place. As it is in minted gold, in English guineas, it is, of course, exempt from duty."
"Does it amount to a great deal?"
"The number of guineas I cannot tell, but the weight, I believe, is somewhere between 5 and 6 tons. That is why I must beg you to do me the very great kindness of giving this vessel a berth against the quay, and, if you possibly can, to lend me a score of trustworthy, able-bodied men to carry the chests. Here," waving to two fat little canvas bags, "I have put up a sum that I hope you will distribute as you think fit. May I take it that we are in agreement, gentlemen? For if so, I must hurry ashore, speak to Don José about the gold, and then go straight up and pay my compliments to the governor."
"Oh, sir," they cried, "the governor is halfway to Valladolid by now. He will be distracted with grief."
"But Colonel Don Patricio Fitzgerald de Saavedra is still with us, I trust?"
"Oh, certainly, certainly. Don Patricio is with us still, and all his men."
"Cousin Stephen," cried the colonel, "how happy I am to see you. What good wind brings you to Galicia?"
"First, tell me, do I see you well and happy, kindly used by fortune?"
"Faith, her privates me, but never let a soldier complain. Pray, carry on."
"Well, now, Patrick, I have brought my daughter Bridget and the lady who looks after her, because I should like them to spend some time with Aunt Petronila in Avila. They have a servant, Padine Coleman. But with the country so disturbed and the journey so long, and myself bound to part, I do not like to let them go alone without a word of Spanish between them. Ruiz at the bank has bestoken a carriage with a French-speaking courier and the usual guards, but if you could lend me even half a dozen of your troopers and an officer, you would oblige me extremely, and I should be, oh, so much happier sailing away."
The colonel obliged him extremely. But no one looking at Stephen's face as he stood in the Ringall's bows, watching 8 horses draw a lumbering great coach up the hill behind Corunna, with a cavalry escort before and behind, and 2 hands, waving white handkerchiefs, waving and waving until they were lost in the distance, would have thought that he looked, oh, so much happier.
"Now, sir," said Reed, in an embarrassed, compassionate voice as Stephen came into the cabin, "we mean to cast off our moorings the moment this hulking great Portuguese gets out of the way. But I do not believe, sir, that you ever told me our next rendezvous if we did not find the Commodore at the Groin."
"Did I not?" asked Stephen.
He pondered and pondered.
"Jesus, Mary, and Joseph," he murmured. "I have forgotten its name. The word is on the top back edge of my mind. It eludes me. Petrel's nest there. Perhaps puffins. Bats in a vast great windy cave some way out in the sea. Islands. I have it! The Burlings! The Burlings it is, on my soul!"